This is Through the Pickets, a podcast proudly brought to you by the New Zealand Cricket Players Association, where we showcase our members' interests, achievements and experiences either side of the white picket fence, with more of a lens on their off-field endeavours. Today's episode features another incredibly talented individual who represented New Zealand in both cricket and hockey, has scored over 5,000 runs across their domestic and international career, and worked as a recruitment consultant. At present, Liz Green is a general manager of Cricket Wellington, the Basin Reserve Trust, and the New Zealand Cricket Museum. Liz Green, welcome to Through the Pickets. Great to have you along, and thank you for making time for us. Now, Liz, as we record this, the White Ferns are in Birmingham competing in the cricket at the Commonwealth Games, and your wife, Maddie Green, is over there with the team. Great start for the side, by the way. Win over South Africa just the other day, and we have Sri Lanka and England coming up. As I said, we're recording this actually just before those games, but the podcast will come out just after the Sri Lanka game. So I guess the big question is, have you talked to Maddie? I don't know if you've checked her social media. There's a few photos floating around. She looks like she's having a bit of a ball.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm still recovering from a late night the other night. It was quite an exciting game. The fact that they could get away to a win early on was always a good sign. But yeah, I think, you know, Maddie's first sort of impression of the Commonwealth Games, I think she's used the word overwhelming a lot. I think there's just a lot of people around. It's obviously a new format for the girls to get involved with. So I think she's settled in now. The girls are settled in. Nice to get a win under the belt early on as well. And I've seen some pictures of the girls floating around the basketball and the hockey and things like that. So I think they're getting amongst it as well, which is good to see.
Fingers crossed everything going well. Podcast will come out in about 2 or 3 days' time. So I'm guessing then you are getting up at 5 a.m. to watch the Sri Lanka game tomorrow.
Yeah, and I'm not a morning person either, so it shows you how much I love Maddie. But yeah, look, my alarm will be set for 4:59, not a minute early. But yeah, I'm really excited to watch the girls in action, and fingers crossed they can make it through that pool stage. But all signs are looking good, and I really hope I haven't jinxed them.
Hey, you guys got married in 2019, and the reason I know that, I saw your wedding photos, which are amazing, by the way, beautiful, beautiful photos. Did you guys meet through cricket? Am I allowed to pry into the personal life a bit?
Yeah, look, the standard story, met through cricket. I met Maddie for the first time down at Lincoln University. She was on the bowling machine and I'd just come back from England. But yeah, we'd been friends for a few years before it evolved into something else. But I still remember it very clearly. I had a text from Maddie saying, welcome home. And things just emerged from there. So getting married to Maddie is still the best thing that's ever happened to me. We're very fortunate enough to get married at Mudbrick in 2019. It feels like a long time ago. But yeah, I think that day, a lot of planning went into it, and it always goes by far too quickly. I think I had a bit of post-wedding depression because it was just such a special day. But the last 8 or 9 years, Maddie's been a real constant in my life and a real stabiliser. She's got the nickname Steady Eddie for me because I think she's certainly calmed me down a lot and certainly helped me turn a page in my life. For that, I owe her quite a lot, to be honest. She's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me, to put it politely.
Let's be fair, I'm sure she's very lucky too. Yeah, you're a bit of a catch yourself, if I can say that.
Yeah.
I'm sure if I interviewed Maddie, she'd probably be saying pretty much the exact mirror of what you're saying in the other direction.
We'll see about that.
Well, I have her on the phone.
Yeah.
Liz, we were supposed to catch up way earlier. However, you suffered a pretty significant health scare that sounded very concerning at the time.
Yeah, look, I think it was about a year ago that we were meant to have this podcast. And yeah, I guess I haven't spoken to it more widely than my sort of close friends and family and obviously work. But yeah, about this time a year ago, I had a really bad headache, I guess, constantly for about 2 weeks. Went to a couple of doctors. I do suffer from migraines, so was just sort of shrugging it off as one of those, and kind of came and went for a period of about 7 days, and then just gradually got worse and worse. And then my eyesight started to deteriorate with it. And I remember being at the Mace tour that the Black Caps had at Te Papa, and I couldn't open one of my eyes, and I was just sort of squinting a lot. And a few of the staff were giving me a bit of grief around maybe it's just old age and I needed to get my eyes checked. So by that stage, I'd been to a couple of doctors. They'd said it was just stress and I'll come right. So I booked an appointment at OPSM, watched some of the Olympics in the morning with one eye permanently shut. I started to feel quite dizzy and thought, well, maybe something's not quite right here, but kept dismissing it as just in my vision. But went into the optometrist, and very quickly I learned that things weren't quite right. I remember being quite distressed and calling my mother-in-law because Maddie was at camp and I didn't want to worry her. And I just said, look, I think I'm in big trouble here. The optometrist had called ahead to the hospital and said I needed to get in ASAP. So my Blaze manager came and got me from home. I don't know why I'd been driving, but I was driving with one eye, which probably wasn't the best thing. And, you know, I guess in those states, you do think the worst. And I was thinking, you know, is this a brain tumor? Is this the end of the line for me? So I started to get quite distressed, and the doctors and nurses at Wellington Hospital were fantastic. And I think within 3 hours, Val had got on a plane from Auckland and was by my bedside at the hospital. They'd run all the tests. Thankfully, the first test came back with no tumor, which was a big relief. And I was just about to get dismissed to go home and, you know, come back in a couple of days to get another couple of tests done. But thankfully they ran one last CT scan with dye. And at that stage, it showed that I had quite a big blood clot at the back of my brain. So yeah, I guess relief in some ways that it wasn't a tumor, but certainly a big moment in my life, learning that I had that blood clot in the brain, and it had agitated my optic nerve so much that I developed double vision, which stayed with me, from the end of July, and I didn't come right until just before Christmas. So I was rocking a pretty sexy eye patch there for a while, and I had glasses with a prism on it. So yeah, certainly a big wake-up call for me, but Maddie was absolutely incredible. She delayed her trip to England. She was reluctant to get on that plane, but she stayed with me for a couple of weeks. I was having Clexane injections in my stomach twice a day, having blood tests every other day. So I was black and blue by the end of it. And by that stage, we were heading into lockdown as well. And the Kerrs kindly took me in and looked after me while Maddie was away. So yeah, a period of my life that certainly gave me a bit of a jolt and a bit of a kick up the ass, to say the least, in terms of my lifestyle and things like that. So I'm still on blood thinners and can't do any extreme sports or anything like that because I bruise like a peach these days. So yeah, a pretty scary moment, but I'm pleased to come out the other side now and more aware, I guess, of my health than I was 12 months ago.
Did they re-CT scan to see that, you know, all the Clexane had thinned it out and it's gone through?
Yeah, I was quite sick for about 10 days after the initial assessment. So I went back to the hospital. They ran a CT scan pretty quickly and it was already starting to reduce in size, which was a good sign. And I've recently just had my 12-month annual checkup and the clot has completely gone, which is a good sign, and there's no emerging clots. So I'm in the clear for now, but blood clots have a funny way of emerging, and so I've just got to keep mindful of that going forward.
You're a remarkable woman, a double international in both hockey and cricket, and at present you're the GM of Cricket Wellington. Now, how did you find that transition from sport through to your working life?
Yeah, I guess I was always mindful of that transition. I was playing cricket and hockey in a time that we weren't fortunate enough to be full-time athletes. So I guess, you know, through my parents and through my upbringing, I was always really conscious that cricket and hockey weren't going to necessarily bring in the income. So, you know, I put a lot of time and effort into my study and eventually had to get a job as well. So for me, it was relatively easy. But then before I started at Cricket Wellington, contracts started to become a thing. And I did take one contract way back in 2016, I think, and I was still trying to work full time. And I know, you know, these days you just can't do that. So for me, you know, working and training was always part and parcel of the commitment you made to being an athlete at that top level. So transitioning out into the real world, as they put it, didn't come as too much of a shock to me, but I did have to sort of make that decision pretty early on in my career at Cricket Wellington, whether or not I was going to keep trying to make the White Ferns and keep playing for the Blaze, or put my career first, which I did about 3 years ago.
Everyone I've spoken to about you, Liz, has told me that everything you tackle, you take it on at 123%. You're just like absolutely full on.
Yeah, and I think sometimes to my detriment, you know, just on that previous point around having to do both, I think I probably, I look back with a tinge of regret about my hockey and cricket careers. I don't think I ever really gave both a good enough crack, and I'll always look back in hindsight with a bit of regret around how I tackled my commitment to sport. But yeah, I think and trying to make up, I guess, for maybe some of that regret, I certainly want to make something out of myself in my career, whether that be in sport or in another field. So yeah, for me, I guess tackling things at 120% percent sometimes ends up with me in hospital. But yeah, I think I've always just been mindful that, you know, especially with my age and things like that, that that a career had to be a priority for me as well. So yeah, I guess hasn't always gone to plan, but where I stand today, I feel quite proud in what I've achieved and what I've managed to be able to do with my 34 years on this earth.
Being able to represent New Zealand in two sports, most people say, geez, that's, you should be patting yourself on the back. So where's that little bit of doubt coming from?
Oh, I guess there's a period of 5 years there, I think, where I was probably at the peak of my hockey and probably just starting out in my cricket career for the White Ferns. But in many ways, I wish I could go back and revisit those 5 years. And I think, you know, for me, I probably wouldn't recognise the person that I was during that time. I was sort of trying to figure myself out from a personal point of view. I know I certainly wasn't honest with myself. I wasn't honest with the people around me. And I probably always thought that cricket and hockey would always be there. And giving it that level of commitment, you know, I think at times wavered, and I found myself in England, and that was quite a tumultuous time for me, to be honest. I came back in 2014 and spent a year at home trying to finish my master's, and yeah, I think I just had to reset myself a little bit. You know, I certainly wasn't proud of the person that I was for a period of time there, and I was making some decisions that in hindsight were completely the wrong decisions. But when you're that age and when you're trying to figure everything out, and you know, I didn't really have that support network around me to sort of, you know, pull me back in line or tell me to pull my socks up. Yeah, and that's where I guess the impact of Maddie and the influence of Maddie and her family and my close friends as well sort of reset me for a period of 12 months there, and I moved to Auckland and haven't really looked back. But I do wish that I'd given hockey more of a crack, wish I'd given cricket more of a crack as well. So probably wasn't until the last 4 or 5 years of my cricket career that I really felt like I was doing myself service and honouring, I guess, the talent that I had. So, yeah, I guess for me, yeah, it looks good on paper that I'm a double international, but yeah, it's tinged with a little bit of regret in terms of maybe what I could have been.
Liz, when I was looking at your job description, it's got GM Cricket Wellington, and then you've got the Basin Reserve Trust and the New Zealand Cricket Museum. And I was sort of sitting there thinking, it's quite a diverse role, because you've got the trust, which is a not-for-profit. Then you've got the commercial responsibility of bringing punters in through the gate with the GM role. And then, of course, you've got the New Zealand Cricket Museum, which, you know, there's all the history and everything that goes around that. Again, you know, they're just completely different roles, all in one.
I sort of pinch myself a little bit in a sense that I've been given this incredible opportunity under Cam Mitchell, who's the current CEO of Cricket Wellington. He met me for a coffee, gosh, way back in 2017, I think, in Auckland. And within a month, I was in Wellington, came on board on a 12-month contract as special projects manager. So I think for him, he was sort of dipping his toes in terms of maybe what he saw in me and seeing if I could deliver on that. And I think over the last 5 years, my role at Cricket Wellington has evolved, and I've been exposed to different facets of sports administration. And I know that I wouldn't get that sort of opportunity anywhere else. So Cam's had a huge influence, I guess, in terms of where I was in 2017 to where I am now. And, yeah, over the last sort of 12 to 18 months, I've taken on a lot more responsibility and managing the Basin Reserve Trust and, you know, having effectively three boards that I'm managing and reporting to has been a real baptism of fire at times. But I've had Cam's backing the whole time. He sort of puts it as being a CEO but having the safety net of him. So, you know, for him to step aside and sort of mentor me through managing, you know, these three different areas of the Basin Reserve Trust, the New Zealand Cricket Museum and the Wellington Cricket Trust has been, yeah, a real privilege, I think, you know, to have someone like Cam backing me. But, you know, the Basin Reserve Trust, I've got Alan Isaac as chair and I've got a great board there. Alan's been fantastic in terms of his support of me as well. But, yeah, that's been a really enjoyable part of my job in terms of managing a venue and all that comes with that territory. You know, we've had a couple of concerts, we've had a couple of beer festivals. So learning how to manage the venue from an event perspective has been really interesting. So, you know, sort of different take on sports administration. And obviously the Basin is part of the council controlled group as well. So, you know, I'm sitting there in meetings with CEO of the Zoo, Sky Stadium, Zealandia, all those, you know, sort of different people and different networks that I've been exposed to as well have been really cool. And I guess managing a museum was never part of the plan, but getting exposed to that too was pretty cool. And, you know, we closed the New Zealand Cricket Museum doors in 2018. So to be part of, I guess, the re-establishment of the museum and opening the doors in December last year was a real high point for me in my career and my time at Cricket Wellington. And again, managing a different board, different push and pull factors, and now we're working on a digital museum stage two. So lots of different components, but it's been something that I've really enjoyed, and I've had to learn as I sort of go, but that's probably reflective of my time at Cricket Wellington with everything that I've had to learn on the go. I knew nothing about commercial partnerships when I started in 2017, but that's been a key component of my role for the last 5 years. We've got great partners at Cricket Wellington, and just learning, I guess, how to lead on strategy, how to lead on operational plans, how to build budgets. Yeah, Cam's sort of given me all that I need to know. So, you know, for sort of what comes next as well.
Before this, you worked as a recruitment consultant, helping sports people get into careers. You know, that whole idea of life after sport, obviously that's been with you for a while, but it must have been a nice feeling, you being an elite athlete, trying to forge your own career and being able to help other athletes that were kind of going, I don't know what to do after I finish my sport. I kind of like this, or maybe I like that, or I haven't really done anything else.
Yeah, I think, transitioning into that job with Global Elite Sports, was a great 2 years in my career. It certainly opened my eyes in terms of what roles are out there, what requirements you needed to take on various sort of challenges within the sports field. So, for me, working under Richard Stenhouse was a great new challenge. I actually got that job because San Shaw, I was working quite closely with at the NZCPA, gave me the nudge to say, hey, look, I think, have a look at what opportunities arise in terms of this job. And working with Richard was awesome. And I worked under Nathan McCullum and Rob Badenhorst, who were previous cricket players as well. So, they were on the stellar recruitment side of things. But, yeah, I think I really enjoyed the relationship management with the organisations as well. Being able to help fill their roles with really talented people filled me with a lot of satisfaction. And I know that there are a couple of people still in roles that I filled. I think Jason Niles is still at Essex. He was a hockey player that I knew through the network. So, yeah, for me, I think what emerged from my time at Global Elite was how much I loved that relationship management piece. And yeah, it was a real challenge for me stepping into recruitment. It's something that I didn't really know what I was getting into, I guess, but I had an absolute blast, and certainly gave me those connections in terms of what happened next in my career. I met Cam through the recruitment part of Global Elite, and yeah, that sort of landed me my job in Wellington. So it worked in roundabouts.
You're also involved in the Women's World Cup, making sure that you delivered some matches at the Basin. So tell me a little bit about that experience and working with someone like Andrea Nielsen.
Having World Cup games at the Chalet Basin Reserve, we haven't had World Cup games there for a number of years. So to finally welcome World Cup cricket back to the venue was a real honour. And certainly seeing how it all came together in the background was just incredible to be part of. Andrea Nielsen is just, to put it honestly, she's one of my idols. I think she's incredible, and how she pulled off a World Cup in COVID times is beyond me. But she had a great team behind her, and just her leadership and vision, I think, delivered an exceptional World Cup. And to be part of that was something really special. We had a great team at Cricket Wellington. We pulled together a little working group, and we all, got so much out of just being part of that event and hosting New Zealand and Australia in the first game. You kind of look back on that and you go, that's going to be a career highlight. But I think one of the big things for me, we had a game, England versus Bangladesh, on a Sunday, and I was kind of thinking, right, we're not going to get many people here. And it was a nice sunny day in Wellington for once, but I think we would have got about 1,500 to 2,000 people through the gate. And for it not to be a White Ferns game, I think that for me sort of sums up, how successful that World Cup was. Andrea and her team got cricket on the map, and people wanted to watch it and consume it. And yeah, I just think, that leading into a sold out World Cup final, just a monumental moment for women's cricket in New Zealand and also globally, I guess.
You only retired recently, but how much has the game changed? In fact, women's sport changed in both cricket and hockey in your time from playing to today?
It's been quite drastic, hasn't it, I guess? The demand for women's sport has increased. You only have to look at the Euros that happened overnight. I think 87,000 people went to Wembley to cheer on women's football. The consumption of it certainly changed quite drastically. Interest and I guess the opportunity for the female athletes has changed quite a lot now as well. I think it's taken a lot more seriously. And certainly I think probably the last 24 months, the visibility of women's sports. So people are seeing it. They're talking about it a lot more. Like just today, I had about five or six different people talk to me about the Commonwealth Games and how the White Ferns were going. That certainly wasn't the case sort of, you know, even as long, as far back as sort of 12 months ago. So, you know, the marketing promotion around women's sport has changed. I think people are taking it a lot more seriously, you know, and that's come purely, I think, just from the fact that people are seeing it more, you know, more on the TV, more on the radio. Hearing about it, you know, you're seeing it in magazines, you're seeing it on social media. So I feel like it's at the forefront at the moment in terms of sport. I feel like people are really starting to take it seriously. And, you know, that comes just from small little things like investing more into female athletes, more into making sure that, you know, games are played at appropriate venues, apparel, you know, making sure that the females are wearing better apparel. All those little things, you know, I think has changed the state and the perception of what women's sport is. So for me, I might have just missed out, I guess, on that change, but just working in the background, I'm so proud of how quickly it's changed and the product that we're now consuming, you know, is professional. And I just think, yeah, we're only at the start, right? I think what women's sport will be like in, you know, even 2, 3, 4 years time is going to be quite remarkable. So great time to be a female athlete, I think, full stop.
You touched on your studies and your master's degree. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Masters of Anthropology. I didn't even say that right.
Yes, correct. Masters, yeah.
Masters in Anthropology.
People often say, what is that?
I should actually, I'm Greek, so I should be able to say Anthropologia, you know, or Anthropology quite well, but no, struggled.
It sounds sexy, yeah. Yeah.
Masters, and did you specialise in sport?
Yeah, so I guess I stumbled into the field of anthropology. I always had the dream of being a sports psychologist and ended up going to Canterbury University and ended up doing a double degree in anthropology. I took one paper in semester one, I think, and I absolutely loved it. I'm not sure what got me excited about it, but I've always loved writing essays. And I think for me, just, you know, just learning about something completely different. And then I think it was in my third or fourth year at university that I realized there was something in this, just in terms of what was happening anthropologically from a sporting perspective. And a lot of those in the field of anthropology, you know, they talk about culture and society, but no one had sort of had the perspective of looking through it from a sporting lens. So I started to sort of feel like there was something in this that I could study. And I had a lecturer at Canterbury University that encouraged me to have a look at masters. And yeah, 3 years later, submitted a 45,000 word thesis on the globalization of sport. So it was a good excuse to travel. I was in England at the time and not work. So I sort of got away with it through that perspective. But it was an interesting journey. I actually came back from England and ripped up my first draft. I think it was on the emergence of females in sport. And it was a very dry topic. And then I was encouraged to start again, to put it politely. And so I spent the next 12 months at home completely rewriting my thesis and actually did it from the perspective, I guess, of my own experience of the previous 2 years of being an athlete that was traveling. So used a lot of my own field research and ended up with a distinction at the end of it. So quite a journey.
Woo, go Liz.
I don't know how, because there were some dark days there where I was thinking I've just wasted 3 years of my life and I'm not even going to pass my master's, and you know, the disappointment of facing my parents and those around me. But I managed to scrape through, and I think when you start to become passionate about something, I found that the 45,000 words came pretty easily.
To me, it just sounds daunting. When you said that, I thought, if I was standing there with word one or a blank sheet of paper or the laptop or whatever you're using in front of you going, okay, what's my first words?
Yeah, and I had similar feelings, to be honest. And, you know, I think if I was to read through my thesis now, all of my assumptions have sort of come true in many ways. You know, I sort of stated that female cricket needed investment and needed to play different nations and things like that. And it's all sort of become a reality. So my thesis wouldn't be much good these days, but I'm certainly proud that I guess I predicted maybe what should have happened and what has happened in women's cricket.
You must have liked the sound of the new master agreement, all members under the one umbrella, a big leap forward for all our members.
What I learned through that process, and look, I think it is absolutely incredible, but there's a lot of advocacy for equality now. And I think the voices and the noise was too loud to ignore for New Zealand cricket and NZCPA. And I'm so glad that we've landed in the position that we have you know, this is sort of the first stage of that decision, I think. And I've said it to a lot of people, but we won't really see the outcomes of this decision until, you know, 4 or 5 years down the track, where we have got so many females in the network playing cricket. You know, it's a viable option as a career. You know, domestic cricket's going to go from strength to strength. I think it's a real kickstarter in terms of what the future will look like for women's cricket. And again, that, you know, having males support this decision and the male cricketers, I think that's just huge. And it just shows how far we've come as a nation in terms of, you know, what women's cricket should look like. And yeah, I just think this is stage one.
It's interesting you say that, Liz, because I think a lot of women in sport might have retired a little bit before they needed to, purely for, okay, I've got to actually get into a career, I've actually got to start making some money to pay some bills.
Yeah, I certainly think it's fair. And I also think that what this master agreement will do is actually create a lot more competition within the system that we have currently as well. So there'll be a lot more players to pick from. You know, female cricketers won't feel the pressure to have a career and, you know, and try and juggle playing cricket at the same time. So, yeah, I feel this is a real game changer in terms of maybe the approach to cricket as a career from those playing it. And as I said, I think, you know, in 5-6 years time, we'll see the real fruits of this decision.
You're born in Taumarunui, grew up in Masterton. A lot of famous people from Masterton, I noticed. Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords.
I didn't know that. I'll claim that.
Yeah, no, he is. Oh, he's Masterton proud. Brian Lahore, Jesse Ryder, Ross Taylor.
I get a lot of stick for coming from Masterton. Yeah.
No, because I sort of had a look and I thought, when I looked you up, I thought, there's quite a few famous people from Masterton.
Must be something in the water.
There's a few I left off the list. So how did you end up getting into sport, and in particular hockey and cricket?
It's the token response, I guess. I grew up playing cricket in the backyard with my older brother. He'll claim that all my success is because of his, you know, training of me in the backyard. I used to play rugby with him. I was just a tomboy. I really was. I'm the youngest of three. My older sister, she played netball, showed no interest in that. I think mum was always hopeful that I'd get into netball, but my dad and my brother, yeah, they've a lot to answer for in terms of my love of cricket. And I'm not actually sure where hockey came from. I think that was from my cousin, but there was not a lot else to do in Masterton growing up. So you had to play sport or do dancing, which certainly wasn't going to be a career of choice for me. So yeah, I guess, just a lot of time spent in the backyard with my brother and yeah, just sort of emerged from there really.
Did you have a preference for one over the other?
Oh, look, to be honest, growing up, I dreamed of going to the Olympics. Hockey, and a lot of people will say this, hockey was my passion. And cricket was sort of something that I played in the summer. But again, you know, probably growing up, I didn't really feel like there was a pathway for cricket. And I didn't really know much about the national team. But God, growing up around Mandy Smith and then coming to Wellington and playing under Niniwa Roberts, you know, these guys were my idols. So hockey was always my number one sport, I guess. And that's why I went to Canterbury University, was to pursue my hockey dreams. And yeah.
Your debuts came close together. Was there a point that you thought that you would be representing New Zealand in both?
I think I was working towards playing hockey in New Zealand, playing hockey for New Zealand and cricket for New Zealand for a period of time there. I think my hockey selection wasn't necessarily a surprise. I was sort of there or thereabouts for a couple of years. But I tell you what, when I made my hockey debut, I remember it very clearly. We had a series here in New Zealand, and I think I ended up playing 4 or 5 tests for New Zealand. But I came off after a game in Hamilton, and we're playing against Argentina. And I touched the ball twice. I was running around like a headless chicken. I remember coming off and saying to Dad, I didn't really enjoy that. And it was the first sort of red flag for me going, oh, okay, what's happening here? And maybe it was more sort of me speaking from a performance point of view. You know, I'm a striker, and I love having the ball on the end of your stick and, you know, being involved in the game. And I think at the international level, there's a lot of get the ball, pass the ball. And when you're getting skinned alive by the best player in the world, it can be pretty demoralizing. But I did come away from that game, and something sort of started to eat away at me a little bit. But, you know, just ignored that feeling. And it wasn't until I had another Black Sticks camp coming up, and I was playing a game of club hockey in Christchurch, and I did my knee and my ankle at the same time pretty seriously. And so that resulted in me having a period of time off for a little bit. And as fate would have it, I had a really good domestic season, played in a North v South game for cricket down at Lincoln. And it was the basically the trial for the West Indies World Cup, the first T20 World Cup. And I fortunately got the call from Gary Stead saying I'd made it. And I think that was the first time I really thought, oh, okay, I could have a career in cricket here. And that West Indies tour was really, really enjoyable. And I loved it. And it was, you know, I wasn't putting too much pressure on myself. It was a great bunch of girls. And obviously touring West Indies wasn't the worst place to go either. And I came away from that and I don't know what it was. I never really looked back at hockey and I ended up in England and just sort of the stars aligned a little bit, I guess, and in cricket sort of by default just became the sport that I wanted to pursue.
Liz, I know this podcast is about everything outside of cricket and your off-field endeavours, but it'd be remiss of me not to ask you about your time at the Blaze and in particular, just before you retired with, I think it was 3 Super Smash victories.
Look, playing for the Wellington Blaze has been one of the highlights of my cricket career. When I first made the decision to come across from Central Districts a long time ago, I was a little bit nervous, but playing alongside the likes of Maya Lewis and Anna Smith and obviously playing a lot of my cricket with Lucy Doolan and Alex Evans. I look back really fondly on my time with the Blaze. And I guess the last 4 to 5 seasons, you know, when Super Smash was introduced and, you know, we had quite a successful era there for a while. Yeah, I think it sort of came down to, I guess, the players, but also the resourcing that Cricket Wellington threw at us as well. We were able to train together as a group. We had some great coaches. And, you know, I think the introduction of Super Smash sort of, you know, lit a fire under most of us as well. And the opportunity to play, you know, before the men and on TV, I think was sort of the start of the era that we now find ourselves in. But yeah, playing for Wellington has been an absolute honour. And to finish my career on the high that it was in terms of playing at the Chello Basin Reserve in front of the packed out crowd that had stayed was one of those typical Wellington days. And I think we only played 5 overs against Auckland. But yeah, to finish my career on that note is something that I'll always look back fondly on.
I saw, I'm pretty sure it was a publicity shot of yourself and Frankie Mackay. It would have been for a final. And, you know, you guys are doing some cool poses and you have the trophy there. So did you enjoy that side of it with, the onset of the television and the media attention and everything that goes with it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I never took myself too seriously as captain, as those photos probably, you know, showed. But yeah, I think it was just, it was enjoying something that we'd never had before. And I guess, you know, that game being on TV and, you know, playing against the Cantabs is always a bit of fun. But yeah, I think, it probably showed a little bit of my captaincy style. I didn't take myself too seriously. I just wanted the girls to have fun in that playing group. And I think that reflected in the cricket that we play. We just had fun alongside our mates and won some trophies along the way. So yeah, it was certainly an exciting time to be part of the game, especially with Super Smash sort of emerging into the product that it is today. And yeah, I think I'll look back and always feel like I had a taste of what the girls are experiencing now.
Any stories from your playing days, hockey or cricket? You know, previous podcasts, we've had Heath Davis bowling a real pie to a batter. We've had chance meetings with celebrities like LeBron James, Kobe Bryant. You can guess who that was.
Yeah.
Players naming their flat and getting matching tattoos. Anything you feel comfortable sharing?
Yeah. I think probably towards the end of my career, I had made that decision that it was certainly time for me, I think, to step aside. It was my last season for the Blaze. And it was Super Smash, and my brother, who lives in Singapore, had actually come over. And at that stage, I was sort of batting at 5. I was playing cricket more as a mentor for some of the young ones coming through the Wellington setup. And I remember being at the Basin, and I heard, "Go the team lunchbox." And I looked behind me, and I'm like, "Who's giving me abuse?" And there's my brother grinning from ear to ear. And so I got the nickname the team lunchbox for the back end of my career in my last season for Wellington. But it also triggered a case of the dropsies for me. And I remember distinctly I was playing at Bay Oval against ND, dropped a catch. And I normally have, you know, what I would consider really safe hands. I never dropped a catch. I think, you know, always sort of had a lot of pride in myself for being a good fielder. And I could not catch a cold for the last probably 4 or 5 games that I played cricket.
Oh,
and it became
no.
a bit of a running joke. And I remember we're in the final against Auckland at the Basin, Super Smash final, packed out crowd. And I was sort of looking around going, it was the last over, we were going to win. And I thought, you know what? I actually think I might keep playing here. This is really cool. The very next ball, Holly Huddleston hits it straight at me. And what happens? It goes straight in, straight out. And I thought, you know what? if this isn't the cricketing god sending me a message to retire, I don't know what is. So I kind of, you know, it was an emotional time, but I kind of look back on that and smile. And yeah, it was a nice way to finish my career, I guess, certainly knowing that the time was up. But yeah, that's probably something, yeah, more towards the back end, but obviously being at the other end and seeing Elise Perry's foot get in the way of Sophie Devine having that four at the West Indies World Cup is probably more of the painful memories that I've taken with me into retirement.
Representing New Zealand, you've had some incredible moments, like, as you touched on, playing at a World Cup or a World Cup final. Any particular moments stand out for you?
Playing at Lords, and I wasn't playing. I was actually 12th man or 13th man. Not playing that game, but being on the sideline at Lords was, yeah, just something that I'll never forget. It's certainly kind of sitting there and you're pinching yourself going, geez, this is happening. And yeah, I think for me that was incredible. I'll always take with me, I guess, playing at, you know, some of the greatest venues in the world as well, playing at the MCG. I got a golden duck, I think, that day. But yeah, certainly the opportunity to experience some of these venues that you see on TV were pretty cool as well.
Let's talk about your downtime. What are you into? What do you like to do? Little birdie's told me that you've got an informal tennis game going with a couple of current white ferns. There's some tennis happening. Another little birdie told me, it might have been the same birdie, that you go and hijack their dog because you're an animal lover and like taking their dog for walks, but your life doesn't really allow you to have pets.
Can neither confirm nor deny. Yep.
Okay. And that you're pretty good at golf.
Yeah, look, I treated myself to a new set of golf clubs actually when I retired and promised myself that I'd play a lot more. And it's certainly still on my agenda that I want to get on the golf course a little bit more. But yeah, I'm hijacking the Kerr's dog until I can get my own dog. So I'd like to say that Will and I have a special bond, and I mean, I get out and take her for walks, and it's sort of any excuse to go around and see her. The Kerrs have a running joke that I'm not there to see them, I'm actually there to see Willow, which is probably accurate. Just kidding. But yeah, look, I'm partial, and this is something that probably not many people know, but I love completing a WOS jig. They're those puzzles that you don't know what you're... Yeah, so when Maddie's away and I've got time to kill, and I just you know, switches me off completely. And it's probably not a healthy habit because I get quite obsessed with it. And I've been known to finish a WOS jig in a weekend, which is probably quite unusual. But yeah, just completely just switches me off from thinking about anything else, and makes obviously time apart from Maddie a little bit easier as well.
You mentioned kidnapping the Kerr's dog. Obviously, it's something in the pipeline for you. Have you got breeds, names, anything sort of in the back of your mind?
Well, we had a couple of tables at our wedding named after the dogs that we wanted to get. So I originally said to Maddie that I wanted two golden retrievers called Wilbur and Humphrey, I think it was. Humphrey's now our cat's name. But yeah, we do have a breed. So we really want to, well, I say we, but I think I've twisted Maddie's arm, a golden retriever named Gus Green. So not real at the moment, but I think the more pressure I apply to Maddie, I think the more she'll cave. So certainly in the pipeline, that's for sure. Our two cats will just have to get used to it.
Anything coming up for you the next wee while?
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting time for me at the moment. I've been at Cricket Wellington for 5 years, and certainly I think after delivering the Cricket World Cup, I've sort of been thinking about what's next for me career-wise. But yeah, for me at the moment, I'm just really keen to support Maddie. I think she's away for the best part of the next 6 months, and helping her sort of achieve her dreams and watching her achieve her dreams is something that I get a lot of fulfillment out of. So she's got a gig over in Perth at the Perth Scorchers, so hopefully I'll get over there and support her. And they've obviously got a World Cup in South Africa early next year. So there might be a bit of travel on the cards, but yeah, certainly for now it's just sort of settling in and seeing what the next chapter sort of looks like.
Liz Green, thank you so much for coming on Through the Pickets. Best of luck with the early starts watching Maddie and the White Ferns in Birmingham. Yeah, go the White Ferns. Also with Cricket Wellington, and of course getting that golf handicap into those single digits.
Wish me luck.
Good luck. You can do it.
Thanks, Dennis.
Through the Pickets is an NZCPA production. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and our members, make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our website nzcpa.co.nz. If you liked our podcast, please do take a minute to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. I'm Dennis Katsanos, and you've been listening to Through the Pickets.